This morning's talk will again be from all three of the teachers guiding this retreat, and we will be joined in the Dharma dialogue by Dharma holder Mike as a respondent. He'll also be giving the encouragement talk this evening. Case one from Master Keizan's Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. And he said, "The entire universe and all that is in it attain the way in this moment. Ah, I see I come along too." The verse, a splendid branch issues forth from the old plum tree, at the same time obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. Keizan, in his commentary on this, talks about the relationship of Shakyamuni to all beings as being like the relationship of the strings and knots in a net to the holes in the net. You lift up the net and the holes come too. As far as I can tell, Keizan seems to be suggesting Shakyamuni is the net and all beings are the holes. What if we reverse this? What if all beings are lifted up, the entirety of the universe actualized fully in its utterly perfect universing? And what if there's no possible way but to include Shakyamuni himself, by which I mean all of you, as well? We have a tendency in our culture to emphasize aspects of the way pertaining to self, me, how I'm doing, my mind, my suffering. And there's a way that we mistakenly hear that as narrowly referring to one being. And I want to hold up that there is an alternative view. I want to read a little bit from a book called Awakening Together, The Spiritual Practice of Inclusivity and Community by Larry Yang. And a little teaser trailer here. You will get the opportunity to meet Larry Yang in the summer. He'll be leading some kind of a program that will have a feature at the Zen Center and at the temple. So, here's a little bit of Larry's words. The dominant culture's interpretation of the Buddha's teaching is offered through a cultural lens that overlooks the value of togetherness in favor of personal, often solitary, practice. We see the impact of this interpretation of the Dharma in the noticeable lack of emphasis on collectively creating more freedom and less suffering. There's been a great deal of emphasis on meditation practice, awareness and loving kindness practice, even Dharma and spiritual scriptural studies, but these, by and large, are regarded as things to be personally experienced rather than carried out in community. The message of self-help is reinforced by the language in which spiritual freedom is promoted. We can do it on our own. We should be able to do it on our own. And there might be something wrong or broken with us if we can't do it by ourselves. This is the subtle message often conveyed. The Buddha was precise in his guidance, and he elevated community as one of the three most important aspects of our spiritual life in the teachings of the three refuges. He did not do this just to pay obligatory lip service to the collective aspect of our spiritual journey. He was inviting us to explore as deeply as meditation itself what it means to awaken together in community. To explore community itself as a practice of meditation or cultivation. The more interdependently we feel, practice, and offer these teachings, the broader reach and impact these teachings will have in our world. What if it's actually not on you? What if it's only ever all of us together? And what if the enlightenment that we experience, awaken to, or what if the awakening itself is not owned as a state of consciousness by the person you call me? What if it's the universe's zazen, the community's zazen, the world's zazen, the world's practice of saving all beings through you, inclusive of through you? My favorite thing, I think, that my first teacher, Daido Luri, said, my favorite thing of his was that you can't save all beings unless you're prepared to be saved by all beings. One of our recitations says, you can't do it by yourself, and nobody else can do it for you. The only option is awakening together. And it's not just that we come together and sit, although it is true that we come together on Sesshin and engage in a depth, rigor, and a kind of practice that almost none of us could engage in or would engage in on our own. That's true. The community and the community energy enables us to do this thing that we cannot, would not, don't want to do on our own. But also, we, in community, actualize and awaken to the interdependent harmony that is not owned by any of us, not dependent on how it's going for you. And this is why we value sitting still so strongly, sitting still for everyone else, sitting still to support other zazen. As we awaken the value of awakening to the intrapsychic forms of suffering. The value of that is not just for an intrapsychic cessation of suffering. The value is that it strengthens our capacity, enhances our flexibility to be able to work to alleviate social, societal, communal forms of suffering. In a very real way, it's not about you. This is the good news. This is the good news also about the arising of intrapsychic forms of suffering. They too aren't about you. This liberation is enacted only ever by this one thing that is the universe inclusive of you. And the invitation is to practice for, with, amid, surrounded by, and as part of all beings. Ah, I see the universe as it is awakened.
So I'm so struck by the demonstration that's occurring right now of exactly what Josh was talking about. I'm so moved by this moment in time where all of us are sitting together in this building, the snow lightly falling outside, and Josh and James and I committed to giving a Dharma talk in big air quotes together. I think it's so clear that Josh and James and I are not the same person. If you have been confused about that, please come and talk to us about it and don't stop. However, one of the strengths of Boundless Way Zen is how, in the uniqueness of our teaching, we come into alignment around what's most important and find unique ways of saying this thing so that perhaps somebody in this group will resonate with at least some of our words. It does take the heat off being the be-all and end-all teacher for everyone. It's a hallmark of our way because we don't think that the three teachers who happen to be sitting up front today are the only teachers in the Sangha. We understand that there are also many other guiding teachers and Dharma holders and senior Dharma teachers and, of course, every single person who practices the way is finding some way in your life to express and actualize the Dharma. It's both unique and aligned, but not in the alignment of everyone doing the same thing. It's oneness and differentiation interconnected. So the holes of the net and the string of the net mutually depend on each other. You can't have one without the other. And everything is lifted up, as Keizan says, together in this action. And this is what Shakyamuni Buddha is pointing us to in his statement, his legendary statement. Who knows what really happened, but it's a nice story. So many of the things that Josh just spoke about have been in my heart today. And this inclusivity this expression, which is so much a part of our way in the Zen Buddhist tradition, and especially as we've come to understand it in Boundless Way, that even though each one of us is encased in a skin bag, we're really completely interconnected. And this is not an idea, although it sometimes starts as an idea. We hear a talk like this and we go, oh yeah, that sounds good. Yep, all are one. Mm-hmm. Yep, what's for breakfast? Hope we get some of that oatmeal again. I don't know what brought you to this sashin. Maybe it was just to come for the food. And that would be interesting. The food is indeed wonderful, and yet there are other things happening here too. And some of us, I've certainly been to many sashins when the only thing that I could allow to support me were breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Oh, thank goodness. Phew, I got through another round, and now somebody's giving me food. Oh, so nice. The interconnection of everything that happens here applies to the kitchen, to the cleaning, to all of us sitting together. As Josh said, the extreme importance of each of us uniquely sitting upright in the middle of whatever nonsense we happen to be engaged in our little pea brains. We still maintain this uprightness in the middle of everything. That's an amazing expression of this awakened heart that is everyone's birthright. I was just speaking to a friend the other day who's been inspired by Dogen, is not a Zen practitioner, but just loves the Genjo Koan. And she said, I just love that line, to study the way is to study the self. Don't you love that too? And I said, well, actually, I do love it. You know, there's another line that follows. And she said, oh, I always forget that one. And I think those next two lines are so essential, right, to the way we're practicing. What is this forgetting the self? To study the self is to forget the self. And Josh was just pointing to it. Shakyamuni pointed to it. Now I'm attempting to point to it. This vast network of interconnection that we cannot extricate ourselves from, no matter how much we try. And some of us try very hard to run away from the fact of interconnection. Maybe it's our personality, maybe we've been wounded, maybe we don't dare to love that much, to recognize the love that surrounds us. And when I say love, I don't mean some kind of Western cultural Valentine's Day kind of thing. I mean this profound kindness that in the furnace of the world, where everything is burning up and terrible, really terrible, death and destruction everywhere, we can touch each other. We can be touched. And so Dogen continues in that line, which I also delivered to my friend. And then, in a little bit of an adaptation of the text, and then everything will enlighten you. Everything will awaken you. You will be awakened by every single thing that you encounter internally and externally. This is the promise of this practice, got to look at myself first, and then, wait a minute, what's really going on? And look, everything is coming towards me. I don't have to try so hard. I don't have to work so hard to run the universe. I know there are people in this room who try to run the universe. I know that I'm one of them. I know what that's like. And it's not our work together. And of course many of you have heard the teaching many times. If we were in charge, even just for a millisecond of our kidney function, oh, that would be it. I don't know what's going on in there. I drink stuff and then it comes out. I don't know. I had a friend in college who made up all these wonderful ways of practicing. This was pre-Zen for me. He was a bit of a nut, but he wrote a book including all these. And one of my favorite ones was to sit on the toilet and drink water at the same time that you're peeing. I just love that. If you ever do it, you'll see the mystery of the human body immediately. What is going on? How could this be? I can't control it. I'm not in charge of it. A long time ago, I was on my way back to Boston from Sydney, Australia, the only time I went to Australia. And I was, by some mistake, put on the standby list. I lost my seat on the plane, and I was really, really anxious. And I went through all these convoluted things, trying to control the universe, trying to get on that plane. And I did finally get on the plane. I'm here now in Boston. I didn't get stuck in Sydney. And I remember sitting back in my seat with a sudden recognition, a little bit like an awakening, of how little control I had over that particular situation, and then suddenly a huge appreciation for the seat I was sitting on, which had been made by people who were not on the plane and had been installed by people who were not on the plane. All the people who had to work to get me on that plane, the pilot and the stewards and everyone who was functioning to lift up this huge metal thing in the air, fly across the world and land in Boston. A miracle, and not my job to do, not my work. My work was to simply bow in gratitude to the vast interconnection, to this vast net of string and holes that gets lifted up together. One person screws in a screw and the plane takes off. That person is completely responsible for the plane flying, and also just a little bit of the vastness of what we're contained in. And it's almost a cliche to say this. Who grew the wheat for the bread? Who grew that oatmeal? Who harvested it? Who trucked it? All beings, in ways we can never know, have allowed us to do this particular form of waking up in good company. This is profound, and it's subtle, and it's mysterious. It's a great, such a great mystery that if you try to spend any time figuring it out, you'll waste your life. This is not what we're engaged in. Our engagement is to lean back, receive, in a position of receiving what the world is constantly offering us. Not, as Steve said last night, to run around and try to appreciate the flowers, but every once in a while, the flowers just show themselves, offer themselves to us. The snow falling offers itself to us. The company of each other supports us. This is the great promise of this way, of what Shakyamuni discovered so long ago, and what we rediscover moment after moment.
So such a wonderful reminder and leading us through this appreciation for we really don't do very much of this at all on our own. And of course the term that we are given for this is dependent co-arising, that we are legion. The myriad things, the myriad others, and that's all there is. Dependent co-arising, and nothing else. Causes and conditions, filtering down, percolating up into this moment, this consciousness, this heart, this mind. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. That's it. Looked up. Saw the morning star. Breathing in and breathing out. Maybe his butt was sore. Maybe his knees ached. Maybe your knees ache. And he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. And yet we imagine that we are separate. That there was Shakyamuni Buddha those 2,500 years ago. And there's us here separate from his enlightenment, separate from each other. And in Keizan's Taisho, he says, if you want an intimate understanding of enlightenment, if you want an intimate understanding of enlightenment, you should get rid of you and Gautama at once and quickly understand this matter of I. I is the great earth and beings. As and. And is not I. As the old fellow Gautama, examine carefully, deliberate carefully, and clarify this I and this and. And if you clarify the meaning of I but you fail to clarify and, you lose the discerning I. Ultimately, if you wish to know the undying person in the hermitage, how could it be something separate from this present skin bag? Although the seasons change, and the mountains, rivers, and great earth are different over time, you should realize that because this is the old fellow Gautama, raising his eyebrows and blinking his eyes, all this is that body standing independently and open within the myriad things. Let the answer flow from your heart without borrowing the words of former Buddhas or contemporaries. So in the reading earlier, if you are not claiming your Buddhahood right now, when are you going to claim your Buddhahood? These ears, this hearing, is the Buddha hearing. Both you and the name you carry around and the history that you carry and the memories that you construct again and again, yes, and none of that. Just this Buddha hearing. These things that you see with your eyes, even just the insides of your eyelids. Buddha's eyes, Buddha's eyelids. Right here, right now. This body, this heart. All of us vigorously using what the Buddha has handed down to us. Even if you don't realize it, vigorously using what the Buddha has handed down to us. We are not here trying to make something true that isn't already true. But just to realize, to wake up, to clarify that for ourselves, that this, maybe this actually is it. These nostrils, Buddha's nostrils, this in-breath, just this in-breath. It sounds metaphorical, maybe it sounds fantastic, but quite literally, the whole history of the universe leading to this breathing in and breathing out. Whatever the content of the mind is now, this joy, this regret, whatever form for you is this wishing it were otherwise, this heartbreak, enter here, enter here. Let this enter you, receive this gift. I'll be like a smokeless fire. I'll leave nothing out. I'll give it all away. Time swiftly passes by. Each moment so precious. Hard to even wrap our hearts and minds around. What a singular gift this is. Even if we just brush it with a fingertip. Infinite gratitude. The light and the dark. We're not moving from point A to point B here. Just point A to point A to point A. Arising and arising and arising. Using for ourselves the Buddha's gift. Kazan also says, therefore, after his appearance in the world throughout the three times of the true Dharma, the counterfeit Dharma, and the present collapsed Dharma, those who emulate his teaching and conduct model themselves on his deportment, use what he used in each moment while walking about, standing in place, sitting or lying down, do as the Buddha did. You do not have to believe this. Just investigate this moment deeply. And know that there is only Buddha and Buddha.
Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. And he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. Thank you.
So, please be invited to sit slightly more at ease and be invited to come forth in our together practice, our community practice of Dharma dialogue with questions, comments, resonances, actualizations.
This idea of the interconnection, the interdependence of the Sangha. This is my first zazen, and for about the last 24 hours, what I've noticed surprisingly is this this part of me that's afraid to receive that, or to trust that they actually will feed me. They really will tell me when it's time to do this and that. And I don't have to be in this state of worry that about, am I ever going to shower? Will I sleep? Will I eat? And sort of this part of me that was really fearful about, why did you come here and put this responsibility into someone else's hands? Mm-hmm. And so it was really interesting to see that come up, and probably because it's so intensive, it's clearer, but I imagine as I sort of sit with it that it probably comes up in a less clear, it probably exists, but in a less clear way in lots of other places, like even the Sangha when I'm home. Am I really only half putting, am I putting one foot in and not two, because there's this sense of, well, maybe I won't be able to trust them. So that has been an interesting experience.
Thank you.
So I appreciate the way that you discussed that and didn't necessarily feel the need to force your way through it. I think that there is something about just noticing that this is what has arisen. You know, we don't learn to trust without some fear, I think, sometimes. It seems like a natural reaction. And of course, the trust that you're talking about is a trust in the personal first, a trust in the Sangha, in these people, in these teachers, that just naturally takes time to deepen. And I think you're also, for me, what's coming up is a learning to trust in something bigger that is, that the Sangha in a way is embodying right now. But that also, though we may gain glimpses of it, you know, there is the instantaneous enlightenment we talk about, but there is also the importance of gradual cultivation, which is the second half of the chant that we read today. We read the first half. This easing into it, and both sides of that being so important. The immense possibility that's here to let go, to let ourselves not know, to let ourselves not know, and this possibility of gradually cultivating that entrustment.
And I love this sort of pointing to this capacity that we have to not trust, you know, to hold ourselves back. And just your pointing at, oh, I can watch that happen. Like, you know, there's the place where we're like, it's just happening and we don't see it happening. We're not aware of it happening. And then there's this other place, this much more valuable place where it's happening and somehow we are blessed with attention to it and we can see that it's happening. And feel the vulnerability and the tenderheartedness and the fear of being disappointed and the fear of rejection. And then we sort of get to make a choice. You know, do I continue to step away or do I encourage myself to leap in and recognize that I'm vulnerable?
The plane from Australia and how we had very little to do with it materializing. And at some point, Melissa, you talked about receiving. And for some reason, and sometimes I have contrarian mind, so I was flipping that a little bit to think about the implications of the plane that really aren't gifts to the world. And the familiar feeling of guilt when I do intercontinental travel. And are people paid well enough? And what are their conditions? And who gets to travel? And who's banned? And speaking also of the U.S. and how in some ways I have to sit back and receive the history of genocide and receive the history of enslavement and how it is manifesting right now in all of these ways and intrapsychically. For examples. And I actually don't think I have a choice about receiving that. I've tried to choose not to receive it. but knowing that I'm receiving it feels like to me, there's some, I don't know if it's action, but there's like an awareness that that's what I'm being fed and have been fed before I was conscious, like bringing that to consciousness. Feels like it's self in action and then learning how to act. I mean, I make actions in the world, and so learning how to act out of that grieving knowledge. I mean, to know the depths of that is really grief and the wasting of so many lives.
That's great. Thank you. You know, as I hear you too, I think it's really important that you name this. There is this interconnected web of support and of suffering, right? Really, really, we can't extricate ourselves from what our ancestors have done and what our politicians are doing. There's no way to do that. As much as we'd like to, you know, and people do try to, right? There's different ways to do it. I'm not going to listen to the radio or watch TV anymore. I'm not going to read the newspaper. In fact, I'm not going to drive a car anymore. I'm just going to stay home. Oh, wait, I'll have to discontinue the internet and the electricity and the heat. Oh, wait. And then there are people who go out, you know, up to the wilderness and try to live off the grid. And yet they're not extricated, are they? And this is like a burden. You can't help but receive the interconnection. And I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of kind of basic human nature. How did we get to this place? You know, all these zillions of human lives that were lost in a kind of self-serving delusion that is our inheritance, as much as our inheritance is the awakened nature, it's also greed, anger, and ignorance. Greed, anger, and ignorance are so strong in human beings. All you have to do is be with a baby for a very short amount of time. As cute and cuddly and sweet and eyes.
They're so ignorant.
Deeply, deeply. ignorant, and you know, they get hungry, and they're not going to say, "I'll just practice with this." they get angry, right? And this is in us. So I think, you know, all of us in some way are pointing to this, the kind of responsibility for our human nature, and there is a path to not erase it, but to be like caught to it, to say, yeah, this is what it's like to be human. Where do I have a choice? Maybe in what I understand from neurology is that the only choice is just where we happen to turn our attention. That's it. You know, even there's stuff, we make up stuff after we've reached an arm out. There's a millisecond delay, and then the brain says, "I just reached my arm out." But it happened first. So to become very conscious of every single thing we're doing and our complicity in every shitty thing that happens in this world. And then, that's not the end, of course. You know, just like my friend saying, "Oh, Buddha way to study itself." Then, some action of healing can arise. And it's small, but it's profound because we're all one body. Right? So this is our responsibility, I think. So I'm really happy that you brought this in, gave me a chance to say my thing.
And I appreciate you naming can't help but receive. Mm. And this is absolutely true. The only thing we can do is cultivate ignorance and denial that we're receiving. And then as we start to get more than a few steps down this path, we can't even deny as effectively as we used to be able to do. Yeah. And what a gift. What a gift it is to truly see and be broke open by all of this that we cannot help but receive.
Well, I love the way that you put it yesterday, Josh, the sort of that we take on, we wake up to this enormous karmic debt, right? And there's something that I love about that phrasing of it, you know, like, you know, we inherited it, right? And you know, crimes were committed, you know, in passing this life force on to us. And in waking up to it, we have this opportunity to, like Melissa was pointing to, do something about it, you know, to move with great compassion and love in the world, you know, to be endlessly paying off this debt.
Something that I'm just touching into that I haven't really put into words in my own little brain before, but there's some incredible opportunity in this waking up to the worst possible thing that is liberating.
Yeah.
Like, how could that be? I'm thinking back, I just had a sense memory come up of when I first found out that my first Zen teacher was a sexual predator, and I'd been at the bookstore that day, wherever it was, Northampton or Amherst. I think I stayed overnight at your place, Susan, that night. So I'm just thinking maybe you prompted it. And I had bought a book, called Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. That was the book I, you know, grabbed off the shelf and then found out this terrible stuff. Couldn't sleep all night, so I read that book all night.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, somehow all the stuff that we're talking about came together for me in a way that was so profound. I wish that those things weren't true, but they are true. And in that book, Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, it was focusing on using the worst possible suffering to wake up to the very thing that the three of us just talked about, to this vast web of interconnection and, dare I say it, love. You know, right? That doesn't make sense. How could it be that all the terrible things that happen are also part of this web? And it's a koan I haven't solved. I hope I never solve it. But this koan practice keeps us going. You know, the not being able to figure stuff out keeps us moving forward to not to reconcile, but to allow all of these crazy contradictions to be present in awareness. And I think we're all kind of saying something similar here. This is the life we get. There's no other life, as Gary Snyder says. No other life. So what do? And this is the body and the humanity. We're not little puppies in the backyard rolling around. We're human beings. What do?
Part of what's liberating about those things, I think, is that they are a coming into alignment with truth.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of what in fact is, even when every fiber of our being wants what is to be different. And, yeah.
Yeah. All of that truth, all of what is really pretty overwhelming to me. But the comfort, I think, is in what Mike said about sometimes it's a moment and sometimes it happens over time, and you live into it. And I think, you know, the alignment that Josh just mentioned too is, for me, for those of you who might not know, I'm a bit of a crier. but that's what I feel like, that's what I most, that's what I get.
Mm-hmm.
Like, usually when a tear comes out of my eye, it's because I just went,
mm-hmm.
Oh! it finally comes together for me somehow. Sometimes I can't express it, and sometimes it's more of a feeling than a thought or whatever, but I think for me, too, this first sesshin, it's, I'm holding on to that, there we go, that it's a moment, and that it's growing into it. And growing into it with all of you,
mm-hmm.
and all of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Very
beautiful.
That's so beautifully said. As you're saying it, I want to link it a little bit into what Rebecca said and what we were saying. And I want to say this carefully enough to like deeply appreciate what you just said, mm-hmm. Kate. Because I think this is the way the practice unfolds. It sometimes it's sudden, but most of the time it's like what you're speaking to and know and what Mike was talking about. And I think sometimes, you know, we talk about how privileged we are here in the West, you know, we have money. And we're actually privileged to allow a slow unfolding.
Right.
That makes us a very small percentage of the human beings on this planet. You know, and every once in a while, we Western privileged people get a whack, and there's no gradual anymore. We have to just be overwhelmed. And boy, when that stuff like that happens to me, thank goodness for the practice, and I just fall apart. I just fall apart. I don't let myself. It's not up to me, right? It's just like. And the great thing is that if we're scared of that sort of thing, the wonderful part about that is that it's only permanent once. Like at the, and you know, when we die, just to be more clear. but short of what?
And not even,
we don't know. And right, because we continue to be part of the universe no matter what. We're still right, but short of that, there's falling down and standing up, and for me that's what my practice has been like: falling down in a heap, in a puddle on the floor, and then getting up again, and you know. And I just want to tell you one more thing: is that James Ford's nickname for me when I first started studying with him was Weepy.
And And I just want to expand out this scope of gradual. It's even more vastly gradual than our own gradual lifetime. Especially the gradual of this together awakening. Still not yet. And even the Buddha too was gradual beyond lifetimes. And he had many lives in which very little was realized. And he had lives as an ogre. He had lives as a god. He had lives as a jealous craftsman. And as a hell being and a hungry ghost, as do all of we have those lives. So to recognize the cosmic scale of gradual, it is also a relief. It also takes the pressure off as we meet whatever little piece is available to be met.
And just to add on a little bit to this, you don't have to believe in rebirth and reincarnation to follow what Josh was just saying. All you have to do is wake up in the morning and live your life of many lives until you go to sleep at night. There's many ways of understanding this. And also, it's not, I think what Josh is saying too that's so important is this, forget about even the Buddha's rebirths as a person. It's this non-personal evolution that is happening. Yeah. That's what I hear is the most important part of what you just said. And so we might not be here to see things happen, but it's not necessary.
We'll just see it with eyes other than our own. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Aaron.
Yeah, just kind of resonating with a couple of things. I do like to study the self. and in that place, I really I feel a lot of gratitude. Wow, I'm so lucky, to have this opportunity. But just like the next couple of sentences, what luck is there? This isn't, it's not me.
I just want to, there are, one of the things I love about Boundless Way is that our versions of awakening are pretty boundless too. awakening to studying the self is also awakening, right? Like, waking up to that reactivity, waking up to that closing down of awareness, to that, to that place where it's all about me all of a sudden, is an opportunity to be awake. Overwhelming. So that's a practice. That gets to be awakening too. This false divider between enlightened and deluded, just awakening every possibility, every moment. Yeah.
So it's also my first session, so I really appreciate that someone else brought up the immediate challenge that's kind of presented by 10 p.m. on Thursday. Uh-huh. I have a general kind of understanding of, I notice everyone else is very selfish, then I notice I'm very selfish, and where does this come from? I don't know, this is some Camus type of, we're just given this, okay, fine. And then by, 11 p.m. on Thursday, you realize, okay, I'm selfish because I'm vulnerable to other people. And so that's the sense in which maybe the greed, anger, and the ignorance and the interconnectedness are the same thing. They come from the same root, which is horrible, but also good. I was reflecting on what Rebecca said and feeling the pain of other people and the history that it comes from. But in a sense, when we feel other people's pain, it is our own pain that we feel. Which your mom tells you that when you're a kid, you're like, go away. But, okay, judging by the response, no one else's mom told them that when they
were kids. It'll go away, is that what your mom?
No. Yeah. So I would tell her to go away, and she would say, you know, like when you feel upset, you know, or when you think you're sad for somebody else, you're feeling your own pain in that person, and vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So thank you for allowing me to feel your pain, to feel my pain.
Apparently now. maybe one more?
Someone who has perhaps not spoken.
Thank you for your teaching. Well said.